You're listening to Razza Riffs with Keith Razza and Alan Lee, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. I'm Keith Razza with my trusty sidekick, Alan Lee, who's rushing to put on his headphones.
It doesn't look like he's rushing. It looks like he's trying to figure them out.
I
like,
know.
It's like he's first being introduced to them or whatever. Were you frozen in an iceberg for a while and then discovered by some high school kids?
Yes, a decade.
Okay, it was good.
He's only done 100 episodes.
The 70s.
101's the charm. That's what my grandfather said
when
he died at 99.
And then we have our guest, the Great Hal Sparks.
That's right.
In studio. How are you, man?
I'm spectacular, but I'll get better, you know.
Yeah.
There you go.
How is traffic? Because I was getting a heart attack. I was like, oh, my God. Where's Hal?
Dude, it's L.A. It's off and on. I mean, it's always a multitude of factors in my life beyond just traffic itself. You know, we live in a stackable society, so there's always something on top of it, and not the least of which is that I FaceTime with my kid every Thursday, and so that always pushes whatever I'm doing until he decides we're done.
Yeah.
So life always gets that, you know. I try to put as much pad on it as possible in life, but it doesn't always exist, and I'm never going to cut him off.
Yeah,
because he's 8 and he's my son. I love him. So
8's a good age.
All else goes to the wayside. They're all good ages.
Yeah.
Like anybody who gripes about any age their kid is can go pound sand.
Now, do you live in LA or Vegas?
Both.
Oh,
yeah. So I my girl and I have a house in Vegas, and then I live in LA too. I have a place here. Mainly because, you know, it's like commuting to a steel town for work. It's it's the main city in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough though, The industry had been shifting quite a bit anyways, but I think like coronavirus is pushing everybody in a direction of like, how can we telecommute all of life? Like we're all going to be in these columns full of water, with a respirator put in us, directing, communications through our eyeball blinks,
Are you scared of this coronavirus?
I'm very concerned. I'm not scared of it. It's not diminishing my behavior, but I'm very aware. Because if you're relatively healthy and you're not worried about I feel like I can weather it. Most of the people in my age range can weather it. There's some rare exceptions, but that's the main thing. The problem is passing it on to people who can't, and you don't want to be the domino.
No. Right.
And so the thing that concerns me and why you should wash your hands and cough and sneeze into your elbow and be an adult is, and by the way, Purell does not help with viruses. That's for bacteria.
Yeah, and they think it does.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
You have to, there's a fatty outer coating to viral cells, and the only thing that gets rid of them is soap and water.
Yeah.
You have to do that. You ever seen somebody scrub up before surgery? That's why they're doing it. If they could just Purell before surgery and it wasn't a problem, they just do that. But it's a very specific thing. So I just don't want to be that domino. I don't want to give it to somebody who gives it to somebody who gives it to somebody who gives it to somebody who can't fight it off.
Yeah.
And having spent a lot of time in China over the last couple of years, I know for a fact that the numbers coming out of there were soft intentionally, that the threat is way higher, probably by a factor of 10.
Wow. That scares me too.
Yeah. It's not small. They're not rolling in mobile crematoriums to deal with that kind of, to deal with the, 6 out of 1,000.
Yeah. So if there's 6 U.S. cases, there's probably like 40 times that, right?
Yeah, something in that order. I mean, there's a lot of people who have it, who will pass through it, and it won't be that severe. Yeah, they'll carry it to somebody else. The problem is, and the part that concerns me the most, is the diabetics, for whatever reason, are in incredible danger from it because of other aspects. And we have a huge diabetes problem in the United States. So most people think, well, I don't really get the flu. I'm not really worried about my lungs. I haven't got pneumonia or bronchitis.
Any
pre-diabetic.
Pre-diabetic.
Yeah. Well, that's, aren't we all?
Yeah,
to some degree,
that's
right?
That's what.
True. But the idea being that all the diabetics in this country, the obesity epidemic we have in this country, massively affects who can be affected by this.
Right.
Massively. And that's my concern. You know what I mean? The cascading effect of that. Because people with a taxed immune system don't need another thing, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah. So I have this weird question for you. Between me and Alan.
Prove it.
Yeah. Between me and Alan, who do you think will get it first?
Oh,
Jesus.
Oh, I
of course it would be, right?
I don't know. Have you ever smoked?
Never.
Either of you?
No.
Okay. Vaped?
I'm not a smoker. Excuse me?
Vaped?
Nope.
No. Okay. So no, you're not smokers or vapers.
No.
You live in, how long have you lived in L.A.?
I actually live in Huntington Beach.
Okay. But the general L.A. area?
Oh, my whole life.
Okay. All right. How old are you?
I just turned 33.
Oh, okay, cool. And you?
I can't remember.
Yeah, your whole life, basically, though?
He doesn't like talking about his age.
Understood. I'm fine with that. Yeah. Point being is that I'm just like figuring on how much pollution you've had to deal with over the course of your life.
Yeah.
I'll be here for 30 years.
Yeah. Okay, so the air got better here.
Yeah, it did.
About 25 years
ago. And by the airport, believe it or not, if you read the record, it's one of the cleanest airs in that because it blows a certain way, even when planes are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the cases are at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the traffic coming in.
Yeah,
so I live near where people land.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's why we carpool. Like, we usually carpool, but today I drove myself.
Right, because you don't want to touch him. You're just, For those of you out just listening to this, and there's no cameras in here, you don't realize that they're both wearing hazmat suits, and there's a giant wall between the two of them or whatever, and they've apparently filled out some sort of contract they went back and forth on about who can touch who and when.
Well,
it's very weird.
I wanted to get one of your suits from Dude Where's My Car.
Yeah, but that won't help you. The sleeves, the hands are open, the feet are open. There's the hood is, and not everybody gets a hood. I'm the only one with a hood.
Yeah.
There's a reason why I'm the leader of the cult. I get a purple hood. Everybody else is just, you know, the funny thing about those suits is they're basically like a weight loss suit from the 1950s.
Oh.
You know, everybody was sweating to death.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
No, a question I had about that movie, which since we're on that subject, do you think that like everyone loves The Hangover, but do you think Dude, Where's My Car was like The Hangover before The Hangover?
Of course.
You know what I mean?
I mean, you could almost track legalization of weed in the United States to Dude, Where's My Car.
Yeah.
Honestly.
True.
Like there was a tipping point where that movie was just so comforting to people who were, you know, between that and Half Baked. You know, those two movies did more for like, dude, it's pot, it's not heroin, get over it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That era was ushered in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess you guys all owe Philip Stark a gram of something or other. I don't. The funny thing is I don't smoke or do drugs. Yeah. I never have.
Yeah,
I'm straight edge.
Yeah.
Have been my whole life. Yeah. So that's always amusing. And
now, does that like really help your comedy? Because I know guys like they'll drink to make their comedy funnier. You know what I mean?
Well, they think so.
Yeah.
That's not usually the case.
Oh, right.
Usually...
Ron White, he always has scotch.
But that's part of his whole, ethos.
But he's always drinking the scotch.
Yes. Not anymore, it's tequila.
That's right.
I was a barker.
That's right.
Screaming out in the
that's
street.
Right. Well, and he
was Ron White's assistant for 2 days.
And he sips it on stage. There's a very distinct difference from being drunk
that's
on
right.
stage.
Just, you know,
it's an image
it's
thing.
A gentleman.
It's like Michael Anthony coming out with a bottle of... whiskey that was actually iced tea.
Yeah,
you know, remember, ever watch the old Van Halen shows? He'd come out and, you know, playing his bass hole, pouring whiskey on himself out of a bottle or fifth or whatever. And it's like, it's iced tea, dude. He doesn't smell like liquor after the show. Let's not kid ourselves.
I always thought it was liquor.
Yeah, it was. Kind of ridiculous. Dean Martin wasn't drinking.
Oh, he was totally, back in the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, because of that, like,
must have been fun.
I mean, I know weed wasn't in a
everybody's
your
acting.
Character.
I mean, that's true of everything. That's what I mean? I don't think anybody on Silence of the Lambs actually ate human flesh during the entire shooting or whatever. I don't want to, if somebody was method and we found out later, I don't want to diss their system.
No, very, very strong
if they
method.
Flew down to South America and hung out in a weird tribe eating long pig, that's up to them. But, that's the interesting thing about even drugs in the music industry, which have been attributed to a lot of creativity and the like. And the reality is when you make and record a song over time, like the amount of work and re-listening and replaying parts over and over that a lot of you are like, oh, Hendrix must have been fucking freaking baked all the time. No, not really. I mean, he smoked when he was his own thing. He used it socially.
Right.
But a lot of times when he was working...
He was pretty sober.
And it was way more illegal and way harder to get, you know, when you were traveling around. So it was less of a factor. You know, people kind of rewrite history based on present-day reality.
Now, what's that like? Because you also do music besides being a great stand-up. Like, how does that, like... Because I've seen your stand-up, I've never seen your music. Mm-hmm. But how does your mind get creative on like that?
They're wholly different. Mm-hmm. I've always felt like you need, to be a complete person, you need complete outlets in your life, you know? And there are certain emotions that do not belong in certain art forms.
Right.
Like, I think you can do annoyance in stand-up and it's funny.
Right.
Rage in stand-up is too heavy and too ugly.
Right.
You can do faux rage, but that's still annoyance. You're annoyed at something, so you exaggerate it like, you know, Lewis Black or Kinison. Right. They're not really enraged. It's comedy rage.
That's right.
Right. But genuine rage, if you ever see somebody lose it on stage or like the old...
Like when, Michael Richards?
Well, or Bill, or Bill Hicks when he got mad a couple times.
That's not nice.
You know?
Yeah.
Those are areas where it just doesn't fit. It branches over into a different thing. Yeah. Rage in music is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's genuine and it belongs. I mean, metal exists because of that, you know. Mm-hmm. But annoyance seems petty in music.
Okay.
Cute.
Right.
In acting, you can do everything. Mm-hmm. You can have every emotion. You can use every aspect of your life, but you don't get to choose when.
Right.
Like if I come into work one day and I'm like, hey, I'm feeling happy today. Let's shoot happy. Like, what does that have to do with anything? The script says angry. We're doing angry today,
right,
dude.
Right.
You do what's there and what we're, you know, what we're creating that day. You don't get a choice. So in the other art forms, I get a choice of where I put my emotions, where I put my creativity. So all my annoyances and my pettiness and my, you know, sort of obtuse observations about life go into stand-up. And then all my genuine sorrow and anger and emotional distraught elements of my personality go into that,
right.
You know, or even my force of nature. Mm-hmm. Like you can put, mm-hmm. like, you know, I went and saw Kiss last night at the Staples Center.
Oh, it's like their Kiss. Last tour, right?
Yeah. Well, they call it the end of the road tour, which should be called the beginning of the residencies, because that's what it's going to be. Like they're get used to the idea of them in Vegas for 3 months at a time, them in London for a month at a time. It's going to be a different world for touring bands anyways in the future as shows get bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. So you'll go to the O2 not to see who's there that week, but who's there all month.
Right.
That kind of thing. Like like you would go see Cirque du Soleil. That's the way touring is going for big bands anyways. Because people would rather fly to that place and see them at the price than hope they come through town these days with an enormous production.
I know you do theaters with your stand-up, but do you do theaters with your music too? Mm-hmm. And what's that like vibe like?
Well, I do mainly like rock clubs musically. Like my band, like I'm also in a Van Halen cover band called Nerd Halen.
Okay.
And we're doing Petey's in Tarzana tomorrow night, for example.
Nice.
And, you know, that place is... It's a solid rock bar. You know, I do the Whiskey for the Ultimate Jam Night with great regularity. I'm there almost every other Tuesday doing the jam night there and singing, you know, everything from like Rat and Skid Row to, you know, to Genesis or Rush. Mm-hmm. You know, it's whatever's there that week.
Yeah.
It's a different environment. And it's right. The thing about theaters anyways is... There's a benefit to rolling laughter in a big crowd.
Right.
So you can ride a wave on a bigger audience.
Right.
There's a diminishing return on that, though, because the drift of your voice and timing by distance fades. So let's say I tell a joke in a place that has 600 people in it to the back of the room.
Okay.
All of those people see the same timing on the same joke, verbally and physically. They can see me. I'm close enough. They can see my gestures, whatever I'm doing with my face.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They can hear the timing of the joke tied to the last sentence. So the timing of the words very important. Once you get further than that, each row has a drift. And after about 1,000 people, it's really just riot control.
Yeah.
You know, posing as comedy after a while. Like, it's just weird. And you see it with all the giant shows. The rare occasion where, like, I would say, like, Eddie Murphy, Delirious, which was the album Comedian, that's as big a place as stand-up should be in.
Right.
And that's about 3,000, I think, was the size of the space he was in.
Really?
3,000?
And that's... And I've done... Like, I opened for the Bee Gees on Y2K at Panther Pavilion in front of 15,000 people. Did stand-up for them and then did the countdown for New Year's. And you could feel it was like performing comedy off the deck of an aircraft carrier facing the ocean.
Wow.
Like you just heard the waves of laughter go back and then return to you because I sonically don't even hear the laughs of the last joke until I'm on to the next one because that's how long my voice traveling to the back of the room, making them laugh, and their laughter, the sound of it in group, you know, getting back to me was. So it's really an odd experience.
Does that throw you off? Because you have a very quick punchline humor.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, so I bulldoze.
Okay.
I believe in bulldozing. I believe in 90 minutes worth of comedy in a 60-minute set.
Yeah.
And always. My thing in stand-up, like I have some rules for my own performance, and anybody who's trying it, I always give them this advice. But you should always have three times as much material as you have time on stage, no matter what you're doing.
Okay.
Because
that's great advice, actually.
Yeah, because the audience may be with you on one night and everything flows and it all pockets together. Sometimes they may diverge and there's all kinds of like offshooting groups and people who are, you know, came in late and noise and, you know, people who get turned off or turned on specifically by one particular bit where they don't hear anything else.
Right.
You should have enough in the, you know, in your backpack that you can pull out and solve that problem instead of burning the 20 minutes of the show you were planning on doing. You should have enough stuff to get them back on track so that you can finish your show the way you want it, especially if you're building an hour and you want to do a special with it eventually. You know, you craft that stuff over time.
Yeah.
So you've got to have that, and you can always, it's better to cut down than, you know.
So when you're getting ready to record a new hour, in your example, you said for every hour you need 3 hours. So if you're writing a new hour, does that mean you need 4 hours?
No, I have about 3 hours worth of stuff, which is the next show and the show after that, that are kind of grinding in there. So after I finish something, I don't have to go back to any of the bits I was doing. I already have worked them out.
Yeah.
I've rolled them through and then said, this is good, but it doesn't fit in this show. I'll pop it over to another thing and hang on to it for a while. And so I have like, I get a good 20 minutes at any given time that hasn't found a home yet, but is what I consider gold, works really well, is reliable, strong material. It just needs to be couched in something else or paired with another chain of thought that makes it make sense to the audience for an hour, you know.
And now, when you do acting, would you say as an artist, acting has helped your stand-up?
Like they were never divergent. There was never a variance in there. Because a lot of my comedy is informed by comic actors as well. Even, you know, like, as a stand-up, I grew up on, you know, Pryor and Carlin and a bunch of really kind of random people like Gilbert, you know, like
Gilbert Gottfried?
Yeah. Well, like, Gilbert Gottfried was kind of like his own act. He's become something else, and, you know, but the version of him in the 80s was much more like just a character act, like Bobcat Goldthwait.
Or one
of those. Like, I came up on those guys and Sam Kinison and the like. But a lot of my performance was informed by people like Gene Wilder and him pairing with Richard Pryor and their comic acting together.
Right.
The stuff they did on screen versus what Richard did on, you know, I was affected by more of like Richard's early stand-up before he became famous and then his comic acting afterwards. Like, I would argue that like Live on the Sunset Strip and those kind of things are great, but they are more him just TMZing himself at a point in his career. He's just talking about being famous and shooting his car and his experiences, just like personal stories that we would now just have some jerk with a camera find out by following you around and treating you like crap in an airport parking lot. The real Richard Pryor stuff and why he's crucial to comedy is from stuff like Black Ben the Blacksmith and you know, Was It Something I Said and Hank's Place, the early 60s, early 70s albums that are indicative of what he is as a stand-up. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But largely forgotten in the wake of his extraordinary acting career and performance career as a film star.
Right.
To most people, you know, as hardcore stand-ups, we know
that's
that
what people,
yeah.
It's kind of like Bill Cosby. No one knows he did a movie that was terrible.
Oh well, I mean, he was Bill Cosby, yes, right? Not now. They slept through it. But and I, what's our rule on swearing on this?
Oh, everything.
Okay,
oh,
good. Yeah, okay. So I think you
comes
know,
out of Alan's checks,
right? Oh, I had a you know, I have a I talk in my act about this about the sort of state of comedy currently. It comes up only because nobody cared about comedy until it became dangerous again,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I say the one thing we learned from the Cosby affair is never trust a comedian who won't say fuck.
Oh.
Because clean comedians are monsters. Oh, if you can't fuck. In stand up, if you can joke about anything, yeah. as long as you can make it funny, mm-hmm. you're allowed to talk about any subject in the world. So imagine choosing not to discuss a topic in front of an audience if you have the comedy skill to do it,
yeah.
the writing chops, and especially if it's an integral part of people's lives. So, and you go, I'm not mentioning that. Okay, why?
Okay.
I'll tell you why. Because the only guy who doesn't think to make a joke about a body in the trunk of his car when he's pulled over by the cops is a guy with a body in the trunk of his car. That's the only dude who hasn't yet, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, officer, don't move the body when you look in the trunk. Like, that's something normal.
Yeah.
Anybody who's sweating and going, God, why would I even mention a body in the trunk? That's ridiculous, you know, is clearly a murderer and there's going to be thumping and screaming coming from the back seat. So, you know, that's always been a question. That said, Cosby's skill as mm-hmm. a performer mm-hmm. was incredibly refined.
Oh my!
And
God.
It, you know, and is he's a tactician mm-hmm. comedically, and it's mm-hmm. You know, and himself is to this day like a classic example of the art form.
Right.
Unfortunately, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. irony that mm-hmm. those of us that grew up in that era. We were told Prince and Richard Pryor are dirty and scary and evil, and Bill Cosby and Michael Jackson are the clean ones. Honestly.
Wow. It says exactly what happened.
Like, think of that. Think of, mm-hmm. I mean, if there's any reason for an anti-authoritarian streak in anybody, it's that. Mm-hmm. Is that the dude who was in, who I saw for the first time live, and he was in a see-through raincoat and panties. Was ultimately became a Jehovah's Witness, was a, you know, was a hardcore Christian at the end of his life in terms of Prince. Never had sex with anybody who wasn't begging him to have sex with them, like beyond consent. Like, these women were, please have sex. You know what I mean?
It was kind of like Elvis in the 50s.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
sure.
You know, I grew up with, you know, in the world of like hair metal and the like, mm-hmm. and there was always this idea that hair metal was this act of misogyny and it was just dismissive of women. But if you listen to the lyrics of hair metal, it is all enticement. Yeah. It is all alluring. These are all guys dressed effectively in androgynous clothing, largely dressed, you know, in, you know, just beyond gender norms, as we call it in the modern vernacular, saying, I got what you want, not you can't leave unless I let you.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a very distinct difference that I think a lot of people just kind of write it off as, you know, whatever. But like, even the protagonist character in 17 by Winger, which is one of the standout, like, oh my God, those people back then, songs, is this girl with far too much sexual agency who doesn't spring this news on this dude until it's too late.
Yeah.
Is the idea. And this is not like, I'm going to go out and find me a 17-year-old. That wasn't the song at all. The exact opposite. The dude's like, uh-oh. You know, and that's the story, right?
Yeah.
To me, there's that those distinctions are important and have been lost nowadays in our, like, I have a shelf in my house that says evil and a shelf that says good. And I put people on either shelf and they just stay there. There's no middle ground, you know.
Yeah.
Like, that world is absurd, childish, mm-hmm. and cartoonish. And I feel like, you know, reality still is reality, but the way people talk about it online, it looks like they craft their thoughts with crayons and hammers.
Oh my God, tell me about it. Like, I'm on Twitter, and regardless on whatever political view someone's on, they just go nuts. You know what I mean? Like, holy shit, dude.
Oh, they get pillaried, you know.
You especially. I see.
Oh, yeah, but I don't care. I do that to draw fire.
Right.
Because I know a lot of people, you know, I've got a radio show where I talk politics and all this stuff, and a lot of my listeners catch fire when they try to say stuff and the Twitterati come after them. So what I basically do is just stand up, say a version of the thing that everybody's thinking that isn't bad, but because of the language police... People immediately assume its meaning.
Yeah.
There's a group of people who believe that if you draw a blue line on a map, it magically makes a river. And I'm here to tell you that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's not true.
Yeah. And a lot of people think that, though.
Yeah.
And for good and bad. If they go, I drew a blue line. There must be a river there now. Yeah. Or, my God, he drew a blue line on there. He's flooded the entire area. Like, it doesn't work that way. Words are words, and you need to allow them to be just that. So, I do that. I stand up, and I don't care.
Yeah.
And I, like, even today, with Warren bowing out, there was all this talk about it's misogyny and it's anti-woman, and that's why she was forced to drop out, and two angry old white men, blah, 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 are the main people.
Right.
One of whom, by the way, was the vice president of our first black president. So, but yeah, never mind. but I was making the case. Everybody kept saying it was misogyny, and I was like, sexism plays a part, but it's not the primary part of it. And telling people that it does is a message to women, especially young girls or women coming up, that it wasn't that she was a flawed candidate or that she didn't manage to drive home her message or satisfy some of the other voters' concerns about her. It's just that she was a woman. Imagine saying that to every woman in your life. Like, look, it's not that you lost. It's that everyone hates you.
Right.
And I know you think some people like you, but they don't. They all secretly hate you. That's the kind of language an abusive lover uses when they're trying to keep people from hanging out with their friends or talking to their family. Yeah. It's hideous. And so I pushed back on it because I'm like, no. Sexism was a part of Elizabeth Warren's issue, as was Kamala Harris's, as was Hillary's, or whatever. But it wasn't the main reason why she didn't take root.
Right.
It's the reason why women in general have a problem in politics, but it wasn't the main reason why Warren didn't cut through. It's just not.
I actually condemn them for like actually running, though. You know what I mean? Like that, because in the history, no women ran until the past 8 or 10 years. You know what I mean? Like Washington didn't run against a female. You know what I mean? Like that's that's what I'm saying.
I don't understand what you mean.
Well, I'm just saying like that's cool that they're running.
Because you commend them.
Yes.
No, condemn them.
No.
Oh, no. Did I say condemn?
Yeah, you said
condemn. Oh, I meant commend.
Even I was I was confused.
Holy shit.
Right. That's a very important point.
I condemn them for running.
Yeah,
God.
Yeah.
He just said commend. That's not what we're supposed to.
Ladies and gentlemen, call up the Twitterati. He meant it was a typo. It was a verbal typo. Please stand down. DEFCON 1. DEFCON 1.
Like, if I ever blow up, this interview could get me in trouble.
Oh, you're done. They don't even need the explanation. They're never going to hear this part. All they're gonna hear is that one sentence.
Oh, just resonate.
Forget about it.
Just, whoa.
Yeah, good luck getting a job anywhere else. That's being spliced right now.
It's a new video game.
That's right. You commended them. Yes, and I get that.
we got to edit that out.
Right. No, leave it in. Otherwise, the rest of this doesn't make sense. And then I'm defending someone. Then it sounds like I'm like, no, reverse yourself. Say condemn. Like, you don't get to do that to me. It stays in.
Hal, don't you find this interesting? And when you take power, just power per se, in any position, it's genderless in the sense that no matter who you are, man, woman, and anything else, when you give an order, say it's war, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to drop a bomb on a village, and the woman ordered it, a man ordered it, and anyone else did, the bomb still went off and the people died.
Mm-hmm.
So I always felt that, it's what will happen anyway.
Well,
doesn't matter.
Right. Well, the theory has been for a long time, and there's an argument that there's an effective soft form of sexism in the idea that if you put a woman in office, she won't bomb people at the rate that a man does, right? Beyond the fact that, Margaret Thatcher being what she is.
Yes, there you go.
If anybody wants to see what a woman in power is capable of, and power is always a weird word for me. I have to be honest. Like, that word gets bandied about now, especially because, power is two things. Power is control.
Right.
We use that as control. But it's also how we source energy. Mm-hmm. You need mm-hmm. power to run lights. You sure. know what I mean? There's an element of, it's one of these malleable words that can mean whatever anybody True. Wants it to mean. True. But most of the time, it's a denigrating thing. You want to be in control of other people, yeah. make them do.
Narcissist.
And I don't buy it. I mean, I think there are public yeah, servants sure. out there who go, I would like to be president oh, no, because yeah. I think I could do a lot of
yeah,
good.
Sure.
And the idea that they're seeking power for no, power's no, sake no. is either projection on the part of somebody mm-hmm. who right. has an evil heart that they don't want to deal with.
We're going back to the example.
Yeah, right. exactly. But like, do you know who Olga of Kiev is? Olga of Kiev is one of my favorite, like, it's a mild history lesson, but it's pretty great. All you need to know is there were two countries right next to each other in Europe, and Kiev was one of them. And this woman had she was the queen. She had a son. The son was going to be the next king after this king dies. You know, everything's running fine. They're dealing and trading with the next country over. Her husband goes over to do a trade deal with this country. He starts jacking up the price on some stuff. They don't like it very much. So they kill him and cut him to pieces and mail the parts back to her and say, we've killed your husband and we're going to take over your country. And you have your son's never going to be a king, but if you want to survive, we're going to marry you to one of our princes. So you just have to deal with that fact. He's going to come over. You're going to marry him. We'll own your country. And then your people won't have to be enslaved and murdered. And she waits a week and responds and goes, cool, okay, but just be peaceful about it. Otherwise, my people will rise up and it'll be an issue. So send over the prince and 20 of your advisors, because that's how we do it over here.
Right.
Send over your minister of, we'll be there in a minute, dude. Just give it a rest.
That's the 5-minute light.
All right. For the story. they send over their minister yeah. of agriculture. Mm-hmm. They send mm-hmm. over the minister in charge of making mm-hmm. sure the water works. Mm-hmm. You know, all those mm-hmm. the smartest people in this other country. They all come over. They arrive at the castle 2 weeks later because it's a long ride. She goes, the prince can come in first, and then you guys can wait outside. And then after we have our little ceremony, you guys will come in afterwards. She spent the last week digging a trench inside the gate. The prince comes in. They capture him. Crucify him in the square. The rest of his people come in afterwards. They all fall into the pit on stakes and filled with oil. She sets fire to all the smartest people in this other country.
Right.
Right? All the people who make sure shit works
yeah.
are now dead. The prince, she makes him write a letter. She's like, you'll live. I'll let you live if you write this letter and say, you know, send over your lords as a, you know, to escort us back safely to the country.
Right.
And we'll come over together and we'll have the marriage ceremony there. So he writes this letter. She slits his throat, pushes him into the pit with everybody else. Jeez. 2 weeks later, they get the letter. They're like, oh, awesome. Things are going great. Son wrote a letter. Everything's fine. Sure. Send over the ministers. They're going to have a big party for him. And then they're all going to bring her back. And it's all going to be cool. These ministers show up. They go, you guys must be tired from your horseback ride. We've set up the bathhouses for you. Go on in there. You know, disrobe. We got all these ladies in there for you. They're going to help you scrub you down. Midway through the bath, all the ladies are gone all of a sudden. And a bunch of dudes run in with buckets full of oil and toss it on the water, and they burn these fuckers alive.
Wow. It was like Game of Thrones.
Wait. Then she takes all her people, her ministers, her warlords, her folks. They all ride over to this other country with all her forces and go, all your people are dead. Your son is dead. Your ministers are dead. Everybody who knows how to run your country is dead and burned alive. Here's their heads, by the way. Mm-hmm. So here's what's going to happen. I'm taking over your country, and you're just going to have to deal or whatever. She lays siege to the main city. They won't come out. Finally, they give up because she starved them out. She goes, look, I'll let you guys live peacefully. I'm not going to kill the king and all these other people. You just come out. And all I ask is everybody in the country gives me a token of their sincerity that they're going to live like normal people. I want a turtle dove, three turtle doves and three pheasants. Pheasants to eat, turtle doves, they're used, I mean, that's the internet of the day. They use messenger pigeons for everything. So they go, oh, shit, we're getting off easy.
Yeah.
This crazy woman is going to, you know, she's going to let us just give her six birds from every household. We're fine. So everybody lines up for days. A whole country rides in from the countryside, gives her three things. Madam, thanks for not murdering us all. Excellent. Here's your three turtle doves. Enjoy the pheasants. They're good, better grilled than fried, whatever. And then they all go back home thinking, all right, it's cool. Everybody's crazy who runs this fucking dump. So she'll be just another in a long line of warlords.
Sure.
That night, she has her soldiers attach packets of sulfur and flint to the fucking bird's feet, releases the turtle doves, and because they are messenger pigeons, they all fly home and burn the whole fucking country down. That, I mean, that's Olga of Kiev. Like, there is no difference between men and women as rulers and their capability. Everyone has the spectrum of capability and cruelty and all that stuff. Our goal has to be to civilize people and pick the best people for the job who will handle the real crisis that come before us. And just saying you're a peacenik or a pacifist when shit happens isn't going to solve it all the time. You have to be able to answer all those questions.
Well, how
other than that, I have no
opinion. I like that. Olga.
How are
Olga Kiev. She
doesn't want to go out with her.
Then go look up Jean de Clisson, the French leader. She was great.
So how we got to get going because we got the red light, but where can the folks at home follow you?
HalSparks.com. That's all my tour dates and all that kind of stuff. At HalSparks on Twitter and Instagram. And of course, if you want to watch my, you know, I stream my radio show on the internet. So I do it at InfotainmentWars.com.
Oh, that's cool.
We have the documents. And even though we don't need them. And so that's my YouTube channel. So people can subscribe there and all that kind of stuff or whatever. And they can always, you know, I'm one of these Patreon guys that pays for the Patreon complex.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Hal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Rock.
Sorry, I went blank and didn't have anything to talk about.
Oh, my God. This was the best conversation ever. If you guys like the show, subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts at Razor Riffs and follow us on social media. And follow Hal Sparks, guys. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Hal.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You're listening to Razor Riffs with Keith Razor and Alan Lee right here on LA Talk Radio.